but this is the price you pay for local public public non-commercial radio, is that it doesn't always sound quite as smooth and slick as it does on large commercial stations.
We're probably not going to have time for phone calls this evening, because it's going to be sort of a mini Radio Free America show. Those of you who are in a position to do so are going to want to tape this, and we'll get into that later. But we may at times be stopping to change tapes, since we don't have two tape decks. One of them is making that annoying little beep, beep, beep you heard. That is not a UFO, at least not yet. That is our tape deck. But enough of it. We're going to get to some serious stuff, but I think it's important that listeners be aware of some very unpleasant things that have been happening to researchers who have been dealing with this subject, primarily those grouped in and around May Brussels. A lot of unpleasant things have happened in the past week. Two of May Brussels' political research associates in the past week have been killed and critically injured, respectively, in two automobile accidents. The 80-year-old mother of a third was brutally raped in her bed, right in her own home. May herself has been subjected to a pretty rigorous program of psychological warfare. She has had people coming up to her. She had a fellow come up to her at a movie that she went to, and he said, "Oh, hi, I'm a friend of your bodyguard," who he identified as a SEAL, meaning a naval special forces person. May does not have a bodyguard, certainly not a SEAL. The thing that she found intimidating about this is that the movie, I've forgotten the name, but it involved a fellow putting together a jigsaw puzzle. And she went home shortly after that, and she found a bunch of pieces of a jigsaw puzzle on one of her bookshelves. And as she said, she hasn't had a jigsaw puzzle in the house in more than 10 years, not since her kids were there. She took that as something of a warning. A little later in the week, she received a very serious death threat a little after midnight on Wednesday. Now, something listeners should be aware of is that we've talked in the past about how the Radio Free America shows are being aired on KPFK in Los Angeles. That's the Pacifica station in Los Angeles. They're being aired on Wednesday evening / Thursday morning between midnight and 6. Not the most propitious time, but that's a huge station with a huge signal radius, and obviously there are a lot of people in that area, so it is reaching quite a few people. At any rate, what they have been doing, this fellow Roy Tuckman, who we read about in an article a few weeks ago, they've been broadcasting May's World Watchers show from midnight to 1, and then playing a Radio Free America or other archive show. Apparently May's been getting a very enthusiastic response down there. Something like 40 letters every day have been coming. What came about a little after midnight last Wednesday was a very serious death threat, which May has responded. She requested Roy to take her show off of KPFK, so it's just going to be Radio Free America down there for the time being. Last Sunday, I found a very weird, it's a bronze owl with glowing eyes stuck on a post outside of my apartment complex, and it looked very out of place, and I knew that the owl was an occult and Satanist symbol, which I took as something of a warning concerning our activities concerning Satanism. What I didn't realize at the time, what a listener reminded me of earlier when I mentioned it, is that Los Tecos basically is the Spanish word for owl, and that the owl is the symbol for the Los Tecos Los Tecos Nazi group.
And not neo anything.
Yeah, they go back to pre-World War II. It's not only a Nazi group which hooks up with the death squads, La Mano Blanco, but it also hooks up with our own U.S. national security establishment. And we talked about that last week. And in fact, I think we talked about it the week before. But we talked about a neo-Nazi who was in Guadalajara. And I took that as something of a warning. Shortly after, May has a listed phone number. Shortly after I got off the phone with May on Wednesday evening following this death threat, and I'd been talking to her about, as I said, I haven't received any death threats. I mentioned about the owl and other weird things that have been happening. Somebody smeared some blood on my front door a couple of days later. Somebody pulled up in a pickup truck right outside. I said to her, "Well, I haven't received any death threats, but then again, I don't have a listed phone number." About a half hour later, this is about 1 o'clock in the morning, somebody pulled up in a pickup truck right outside of my apartment building. As I said, it's a small four-unit building. And tossed out a very large firecracker, which, needless to say, rattled the neighborhood. I ran outside, but the truck sped away after that, which seemed a little coincidental to me. Nothing like that's happened in the years that I lived there. Maybe that was a coincidence. Maybe that was just some creep kid. But all in all, the warm and brown is really hitting the fan. Our Dave, our researcher who's been doing our Italian translations, had an interesting experience. He was stopped ostensibly for a minor traffic infraction. I believe a taillight was out, or that's what they said. And then gradually the police, and these regular traffic cops, began talking to him in detail about heroin trafficking. Now, Dave works 70 to 80 hours a week on top of doing those translations. And he's no more a heroin trafficker than he is a deep sea diver or a test pilot, okay? He has, however, as regular listeners to the program know, been doing a lot of excellent work helping to uncover heroin traffickers within our own national security establishment in Italy and so forth, which was very, very interesting. Richard Sprague, who is a researcher back east, he wrote The Taking of America 1-2-3, and he had recently been working with Jim Garrison to try and get a new investigation opened up, actually basically to follow the Senate House Select Committee's recommendations to the Justice Department to open a new investigation. Well, Richard had a serious fall, was critically injured in a fall, and when he was taken to the hospital, they ran a bunch of tubes in him, basically in every orifice, and found a large cancer in his bowel. So he's certainly going to be out of circulation and maybe permanently so. And things have happened to other researchers, too. Some of them don't want them spoken of on the air. Barbara Honegger's been catching some flack. I can't give you the details. But all in all, as by way of saying, it's been a delightful week. And I'd be lying if I said I wasn't a little scared. However, I am going to stay the course. We're going to stay the course vis-a-vis KPFK in Los Angeles. At this point, they've already played most of the controversial tapes, the AIDS tape and most of the rest. So that's, in one sense, downhill from here. However, I think we can assume that if this character who called May up didn't like her program, I don't think he's probably doing the varsity rag when he listens to ours either. Yeah. And this is perhaps seem extremely melodramatic to those of you who are new to the broadcast, but believe me, these things happen. I've had some very interesting experiences in the past. I was poisoned in early 86. May had one of her kids killed. You know, those of you who think this is some kind of a joke would do well to reconsider it. We really are facing some very, very serious things, and my feeling is that it's best that we inform the listeners.
Well, I was going to say is, it's people listening to the shows can consider anything they want to, and that's fine. One of the things that people ask us all the time, in light of people like Alan Berg and others, who it's real hard to find anything too controversial about the verdict of murder in the Alan Berg case, since he was shot down by neo-Nazis in his driveway with automatic weapons. It's certainly no surprise that these kinds of things happen. As to whether these particular incidents are part of a pattern or not, it doesn't really matter. The point is that people always say, well, do you guys worry about this stuff? Well, one of the things that helps to ease worry is the fact that we've always been very public, and this stuff is all very public. And I think I speak for Dave when I say if either of us comes down with some weird tropical disease or a helicopter accidentally crashes into our house, I hope there's 4,000 or 5,000 of you out there listening who will make sure that these people have no peace whatsoever. So indeed, whatever the case with any of these individual things, it doesn't matter. The point is that that's what's going on. The information has been put out on the air, and that's the insurance policy in the long run, and it's the only one we can really hope to utilize, because most of the other kinds, that's about as much insurance as you can hope to have with these kinds of things.
Right, and again, we're going to stay the course vis-a-vis KPFK, but again, we certainly hope that the listeners will stand tightly by us and raise living hell if something happens to either or both of us, and probably, if they decide to move it, probably won't be an Alan Berg type thing. I don't think they're going to get that obvious. It'll probably be diseases or toxins. One of us will drop dead of an apparent heart attack, or we'll get cancer or AIDS or something like that. I think they're going to be oblique. The techniques they also use, though, they will, they might come in and shoot you, and they'll rifle the drawers to your house, at which point you have apparently surprised a burglar in your home. Sometimes they'll shoot you on the street, and they'll take your wallet and your watch or whatever, at which point you're the victim of an apparent mugging. Or sometimes they'll blow your head off and then sprinkle a little cocaine around, and then it becomes an apparent drug-related death. There are also the apparent one-car automobile accidents where, for some reason, you lose control of your car. The ubiquitous apparent heart attack and apparent stroke, the leading cause of death among politically progressive people these days.
And then, of course, there's always the Michele Sindona suicide breakfast,
Yeah.
So
toast with Licio Jelly, as
that's right, absolutely. So there are many and multifaceted are the way in which people who bump up against these kinds of folks can meet their end, and certainly neither Dave or I are in a hurry to do that. Not in a hurry at all. So any of you out there who are in the employ of the government and want to come by and bump us off, hey, take a vacation, have a sabbatical. No hurry. We're in no hurry to go. Okay, tonight we are going to be talking about another serious topic, and a topic that has become even more serious in the last few years due to the advent of AIDS. AIDS has been very much in the news the last couple of weeks for a variety of reasons. One of our listeners called up a couple of weeks ago and mentioned the fact that there was a series of tests being done with an AIDS vaccine that was being done, and the caller was calling up to suggest that it wasn't a very good idea to test it out on homosexual men who are high risk anyway and might already have the disease in a latent form or in a resting form or something like that. Interestingly enough, Admiral Watkins, who we have had cast a very fishy eye on because of his background, whether because we were wrong or because whether Watkins is even cleverer than we thought, who knows? One way or the other, Watkins just came out this week and basically said the same thing, among other things. He says it's stupid to test the vaccine on homosexual men who may be already carrying the disease and not know it. And he said that the administration is basically not doing anything about AIDS, and millions and millions more dollars of research are required. So whether Watkins is a stalking horse or whether he is in fact a legitimate guy, some interesting things happening in the world of AIDS this week. Now, this is particularly significant because, as we said, one of the main differences between the state of political affairs for the gay population now and even 10 years ago, of course, is AIDS, and that has vastly increased anti-homosexual hysteria, and it has caused, not to mention just a hideous loss of life among the gay population. Especially the male gay population. What did I say?
Gail May
population against the male gay population. Not that there was any need to whip up anti-gay furor in most parts of America, but if anything, it has increased. And this is not an unusual or an unheard of thing. The fact of gay liberation, quote unquote, in and of itself is not as rare a thing as those who grew up in the 60s and 70s might tend to think it was. In fact, these kinds of things are cyclical, and sometimes in the past, the cycles have arisen and been met head on by bigger and stronger cycles, and that's particularly what we're going to be talking about tonight.
Now, again, those of you who are in a position to do so are strongly advised to tape this program off the air. I think you're going to find this one of the most revealing and important programs we've ever done, certainly as relevant to the contemporary situation as any we've ever done. And I think it's going to provide some very, very important insights, not only into the nascent gay rights movement in Weimar Germany, how it was subverted, how the Nazis used the issue of gay rights and homosexuality as a very potent weapon to tar the liberals, but also in Weimar Germany, that is. But I think you're going to find a number of unnerving parallels to the current situation in the United States. So again, if you're in a position to do so, please get your tape recorder running. If you're listening in your car or something like that, however, don't despair, because we are going to be putting this on permanent file with our tape duplication service, and we'll give you the address for that at the end of the broadcast. Undoubtedly, since we've already used up almost a half hour, we're not going to have time for phone calls this evening, so I think you can rest yourselves in that regard. Let me give you a rundown of what it is you're going to be hearing on the broadcast. By the way, a special tip of the hat goes to a mutual friend of ours, Andy, who also has carried most of the ball vis-a-vis the AIDS research. He dug up one of the books which we're going to rely on heavily this evening for us. That book is called The Pink Triangle. It's authored by Richard Plant. It's published by Henry Holt and Company, copyrighted 1986. And so, again, a tip of the hat to Andy for turning us on to this book. And we then took his tip, and we've run a lot farther with it. I'm going to give you a rundown now of what you're going to be hearing this evening. Now, we're going to begin by taking a look at the nascent gay rights movement in Weimar Germany. We're not going to give you the historical background, which Plant does. We're going to begin by looking at the principal figure in the gay rights movement in Weimar Germany, a man named Magnus Hirschfeld. And Hirschfeld also was a socialist and a Jew, and so this was used by the Nazis very skillfully to tar their political opponents with the onus of homosexuality. We're going to take a look at Hirschfeld, his work, what the Nazis thought about him. Then we're going to take a look at the attacks he came under from various people in pre-Nazi and Nazi Germany. We're going to take a look at the assistance which the gay rights movement in Weimar Germany received from the feminist movement in Weimar Germany. There has been a certain degree of intersection between those in the United States, which is suggestive of a historical parallel here. That's obviously what we're suggesting with the program. After that, we're going to talk some more about Magnus Hirschfeld and how the Nazis harassed him and the beatings to which he was subjected. Then we're going to talk about what appears to have been a very, very significant provocation in Germany, one which, even though parts of Germany were extremely conservative and reactionary, parts of Germany, for historical reasons we're not going to go into, had in fact developed a relatively liberal attitude toward homosexuality over the years, largely due to the efforts of Frederick II of Prussia, incidentally. We're going to talk about the Fritz Haarmann case, in which a police informer and almost certainly an agent provocateur committed a series of brutal, a brutal serial murder program, some 127 murders in which the victims were chopped up into meat and sold as horse meat. This fellow was a homosexual. He also obviously was a police informer with his own detective agency and appears to have worked in conjunction with the police in Hanover for a long, long time. We're going to talk about the Fritz Haarmann case, how it affected public opinion in Weimar Germany, how the Nazis manipulated this case, the response of the Communist Party in Weimar Germany. We're also going to take a look at the interesting background of a man named Gustav Noske, a last name N-O-S-K-E. Noske was the police commissioner in Hanover at the time, and perhaps even more significantly than that for our purposes here, Noske was the military command. He was the minister in charge of military affairs and later the supreme commander of the Reichswehr and the national security establishment in Weimar Germany. Even more significantly, it was Gustav Noske who pioneered the putting together of the three main volunteer military organizations which fomented the political reaction in Germany: the Freikorps, the Ein Wohnerverein, and the Zeit Freiwilligen Verbande. We'll talk about that later. But Gustav Noske, who put together the Freikorps, which paved the Nazis' rise to power, as we've talked about and we'll go into in more detail, was the police commissioner in Hanover, Germany. We're then going to talk about how the Nazis began to crack down on gay rights, gaining impetus in both before they came to power and afterward, gaining impetus in considerable measure from the Fritz Haarmann case, a probable provocation and possibly the antecedent to the California violences and the Manson family and the kinds of things we've seen in the past with the David Berkowitz killing, the Son of Sam killings, and so forth. Then we're going to take a look at the so-called Night of the Long Knives. We're going to take a look at the purge of the SA by the SS and the Reichswehr, or the German army. We're going to take a look at this in particular because Ernst Röhm was an avowed, self-proclaimed homosexual, and in fact was into a very strange sort of doctrinaire homosexuality, which, to make a long story short, basically regarded men who had sex with women as sissies and, you know, the men who had sex with men as, you know, real men. That's his opinion, not ours. But anyway, we're going to take a look at Ernst Röhm's homosexuality, his desire to have his SA replace the regular German army, which ran afoul of the German military high command and caused him to fall out of favor with Hitler. And we're going to take a look at how his homosexuality was used by his enemies to help pave the way for his demise. We're also going to take a look at the politico-legal significance of the Röhm purge. The Night of the Long Knives, in which the SA and some of its compatriots were exterminated, was a very significant legal event vis-a-vis the Third Reich because it had established the legal precedent of arbitrary crime as a means of state policy. We're going to go into that in more detail during the main body of the broadcast. We're then going to take a look at the use of supposed anti-vice charges as a means for political assassination. Not only charges of homosexuality, but also charges of pornographic and prostitution activity, something that should be very much in our minds as we watch Jimmy Swaggart and Jim Baker and others flail about, and the charges of George Bush involvement coming from Pat Robertson. We're going to take a look in particular at the defamation of two German generals named von Blomberg and von Fritsch, both of whom opposed Hitler's military policy, both of whom lost their careers as a result of apparent blackmail, scurrilous blackmail, one on charges of being pornographic, one on charges of being homosexual, both basically scurrilous. And this should serve as a warning for heterosexuals who don't think that the anti-gay climate is likely to rebound and have implications for them. Then we're going to take a look at an interesting view of reproductive rights in Nazi Germany, and we're going to take a look at the Himmler view of sexuality. We're going to take a look not only at where and why homosexuality was the bête noire for them that it was, but also how this intersected with their whole view of reproductive rights, the role of women in society, and abortion, incidentally. Abortion in a very, very big way. We're going to dwell on that for quite some time. Well, we're going to take a look at that at an extended length. Again, the entire Nazi view of sexuality, meaning not only homosexuality, but reproductive rights, women's rights, abortion rights, and so forth. And then the last two items on our docket for this evening are going to involve the SS and Nazi view of homosexuality as an epidemic. They literally viewed, in a socio-political sense, they viewed homosexuality as a communicable disease and often referred to it as just that. They felt the reason, among the reasons why homosexuality had to be completely purged from the Third Reich was that it was communicable, that it represented a disease and that it would reduce the stock of pure German blood by reducing the number of babies that are going to be propagated. And obviously, this bears an unnerving echo for us in the present time. We've done a lot of work on AIDS as a biological warfare weapon, and it, one can perhaps speculate in view of the massive influence of the Third Reich on the development of our own national security establishment vis-a-vis the Galen people and the paperclip scientists, one can speculate at considerable length on the extent to which the Nazi view of homosexuality as an epidemic may have given rise to some of the planners of the current ailment, which appears to be bedeviling not only gays in this country, but an increasing number of Americans and people abroad. That's what we have on tap for this evening. Again, if you're in a position to do so, I think you're going to want to tape this because we have a lot of interesting stuff on tap for this evening.
All right. We're going to be doing probably the, well, not probably, definitely, the vast majority of our work tonight from a book called The Pink Triangle. The book is subheaded The Nazi War Against Homosexuals. It's written by Richard Plant, P-L-A-N-T, and published by Henry Holt and Company of New York. And this book was the one that Andy provided for us, and we want to give him credit for that.
Mm-hmm. It's also got a nice write-up. People may be familiar with it. It came out to considerable critical acclaim just a couple of years ago.
Anyway, now we are talking about, again, I'm sure that there are people among our audience who are fairly new, and some of the things that we talk about very offhandedly may not be familiar to you. For those of you who are not familiar with the term Weimar Republic, it's spelled W-E-I-M-A-R. The Weimar Republic was the republic that eventually gave way, and one might point out, by elections rather than by an actual military takeover, but it gave way through elections to Hitler's elected and constitutional government in Germany, National Socialist Government. But the Weimar Republic was itself a tenuous experiment in democracy in a Germany that had not had much experience of that in some time. And it was only, in and of itself, was only able to happen after the revolution that followed the atrocious events of World War I had been put down very forcefully. We'll probably talk about that as well, because that was one of the early times in which provocation became a way of life for the German General Staff. Anyway, so we are talking about the Weimar Republic, which pretty much officially came to an end with the election of Hitler and his people.
Right. Now, again, for a variety of reasons, which we're not going to go into here, in the book, Plant traces in synoptic form the history of attitudes towards homosexuality in Germany, in the various parts of Germany, for a variety of reasons which we don't have the time to go into. Certain parts of Germany had developed relatively liberal attitudes towards homosexuality. The relatively liberal attitude of King Frederick II of Prussia had a lot to do with it. Other parts of Germany were very, very reactionary indeed. Traditional German conservatism, and indeed the overall German attitude had been very, very conservative, and with a legal paragraph called Paragraph 175, homosexuality was illegal. However, again, for a variety of reasons, during the Weimar Republic, a fairly liberal attitude toward homosexuality had evolved for historical reasons, which Plant goes into, but we haven't got the time to.
All right, reading from Robert Plant's book, The Pink Triangle, which we'll be reading from more than anything else tonight. During the Weimar Republic, the homosexual subculture had managed an uneasy coexistence with the larger heterosexual society surrounding it. Of course, those in the spotlight, famous actors, designers, dancers, doctors, politicians, directors, and lawyers, had to live with a certain amount of abuse. But many had acquired power, money, and even connections to the Weimar government, which served as protection. The average gay man could live unnoticed and undisturbed unless he fell victim to police entrapment or blackmail. The average lesbian enjoyed a kind of legal immunity. During the Weimar years, organized lesbian costume balls were held. Luxurious lesbian bars and nightclubs flourished. Their owners never feared a police raid. The reason? Neither the Second German Empire nor the Weimar Republic had ever promulgated laws forbidding or punishing sexual acts between women. Lesbian magazines enjoyed healthy circulation, some even featuring personal ads, and a few lesbian plays achieved widespread popularity. But the sexual tolerance so often associated with the Weimar Republic began to disappear as rapidly as Germany's economy began to crumble. The unemployed are generally less tolerant of contragenics. Contragenics is a term that Plant uses frequently, and he's just saying somebody who goes against the norm in this case, because he expands it later to include, not from his own way of thinking, but from the Nazi way of thinking.
An outgroup, basically.
An outgroup. He expands it later to include the Jews, the communists, the liberals, etc. Anyway, as he says, the unemployed are generally less tolerant of contragenics, and this is very true. We'll underscore that. We'll get back to it. Germany, it must be remembered, had never been an ethnically pluralistic society. Almost all German churches were state churches. There were no large ethnic groups or religious sects other than the Jews, the Gypsies, and the Jehovah's Witnesses, the latter relatively small in number. Homosexuals were an obvious, if largely invisible, scapegoat. The years from 1929 to the end of the Weimar Republic were years of mounting tension. The Brown Shirts, or SA, under the leadership of Ernst Röhm, who was himself homosexual and would later be the target of Hitler's wrath, became even more brutal and more repressively efficient. Hitler had promised Germany's youth life as an endless military parade, replete with dashing insignia, badges, and banners. He invented special ranks for SA recruits and later for the SS. He proffered the vision of a brave, sunny world of soldiering for those who had given up hope. His enemies, he threatened, with war and extinction. They would be eliminated, quote, ruthlessly, his favorite word, and, quote, heads would roll. His various adversaries were united in nothing but blindness. Only when it was too late did some grasp that Hitler's program of wholesale destruction would indeed be carried out, its scope widening year after year. The initial misreading of the implications of the Nazis' policy of systematic violence was shared by almost all of those who were their victims. Union leaders, shrewd politicians of the center and the right, Marxists, Jewish scientists, writers, lawyers, and of course, homosexuals of all professions and educational levels. To be sure, a small minority did read the omens correctly and managed to leave Germany before it was too late, but many stayed behind to face their doom uncomprehendingly. Now, again, just to underscore that point, he said the unemployed are not very tolerant of contragenics. When you're talking about outgroups, of course, this has been a major theme of our broadcast. One of the reasons, of course, because Ronald Reagan rose to prominence on the back of the worst recession that the United States had been in for a long time.
At least since Richard Nixon had been in office.
And, of course, with the rise of Ronald Reagan went a not necessarily causative rise of violence against racial minority groups, against homosexuals, against a variety of other groups. The reason I say not necessarily causative, certainly some of it, as we have discussed on this broadcast, has been directly caused by the Reagan administration and their tools and cronies. However, also there have been other elements of it that have been caused merely by the example of the Reagan administration. Plus, thirdly, and the part that's not necessarily causative to the Reagan administration, a lot of this stuff was starting at the time the Reagan administration was making its bid for elected power, because of the climate in the United States, again, partially having to do with economics, with frustration over the lack of control. America used to be a great nation. What happened to us? Again, very similar to Germany after World War I. For a while, Germany had bestrode the earth like a colossus. Now they were a weak and pitiful, helpless giant, and people were looking for things to blame, for people to blame, for groups to blame. And we see that repeated ad infinitum, ad nauseum in the United States these days.
Now, again, bear in mind the relatively tolerant climate of Weimar Germany towards homosexuals of both sexes. Now, it is against the background of this climate that we're going to take a look at Magnus Hirschfeld, the real pioneer of the nascent gay rights movement in Weimar Germany. Returning to The Pink Triangle by Richard Plant. It is in this context that the successes and failures of the homosexual rights movement in Germany must be measured. The movement began long before World War I during the reign of Kaiser Wilhelm II, but didn't assume the proportions of a significant reform movement until the arrival of Magnus Hirschfeld, 1868 through 1935. His name, by the way, is M-A-G-N-U-S, last name H-I-R-S-C-H-F-E-L-D. it would be hard to overestimate Hirschfeld's importance. The attacks on his person and on his life's work anticipate the wholesale horror that was to be unleashed once Hitler had consolidated his rule. Hirschfeld, a Jew, a homosexual, and a physician, was a man possessed of enormous energy, imagination, and ambition. He became the leader of several psychological and medical organizations, the founder of a unique institute for sexual research, and the organizer of numerous international congresses dedicated to research on sexual matters and to the promotion of policies that would lead to an acceptance of homosexuals by society. In his celebrated study, Homosexuality in Men and Women, Hirschfeld optimistically declared that 90% of the German people would vote to repeal the nation's anti-homosexual laws if only they had a chance to learn the truth. His optimism would later prove to be unfounded even after Hitler's defeat in 1945. Hirschfeld's motto was "justice through knowledge," unquote. He was not alone in his belief that progress could be made through the exercise of reason. Other doctors and psychiatrists, such as Richard von Krafft-Ebing, Albert Mohl, and Alfred Adler, shared this belief even as they contested Hirschfeld's ideas while respecting his research. Consumed by a kind of missionary zeal, Hirschfeld wrote book after book, polemic after polemic, pamphlet after pamphlet. His total output, nearly 200 titles, is staggering. Natural Laws of Love, 1912, Homosexuality in Men and Women, 1918-20, Sexual Pathology, 3 volumes, 1920, The Science of Sexology, 1920, and Sexual Knowledge, 5 volumes published from 1926 to 1930, are his major works. Most of the books were quite lengthy. For example, the second edition of Homosexuality in Men and Women stretches to more than 1,000 pages. In addition, Hirschfeld composed scores of articles, book reviews, political pamphlets, and petitions to government agencies. He also founded the Yearbook for Intersexual Variants, which he edited until 1923 and was published, with a few interruptions, until 1932-33. The yearbooks addressed legal, historical, medical, and anthropological aspects of homosexuality. They presented lengthy discussions with psychiatrists who disputed Hirschfeld's work. For a long time, Hirschfeld had believed that homosexuals formed a third sex. He would abandon this notion in 1910. He considered the archetype of the totally masculine male and the totally feminine female as unchanging throughout history, a law of nature as firmly rooted in reality as the laws of mathematics. He was convinced that homosexuals constituted a biologically distinct gender, a human being between male and female. He devoted much thought to establishing fine differentiations within this third sex. The third sex thesis, however, would inadvertently help the Nazis in their crusade against homosexuals, as will be explained below. Hirschfeld repeatedly tried to reform Germany's laws, particularly the notorious paragraph 175. This national law, enacted in 1871, stipulated that, quote, "a male who indulges in criminally indecent activities with another male, or who allows himself to participate in such activities, will be punished with jail."
Continuing, later section. Fortunately, Hirschfeld found some unexpected allies. Let me start that sentence again. Fortunately, Hirschfeld found some unexpected allies in the women's emancipation movement. The most active organization was the League for the Protection of Maternity and Sexual Reform, founded in 1905. Its guiding spirit was Dr. Helene Stöcker, or Stecker, S-T-O-E-C-K-E-R, from 1869 to 1943, an indefatigable organizer as unswervingly optimistic as Hirschfeld, who joined Hirschfeld's committee in order to squelch attempts at making sexual relations between women a criminal offense. And it says in parentheses, the laws were never passed. Stecker believed, and wrote in various articles, that it was senseless to punish homosexual acts. A bond was established between the women's movement and the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, which is Hirschfeld's group, when Stecker became one of the committee's directors. Nazi propagandists would later stress that activities for the emancipation of women and for the repeal of anti-homosexual laws were part of one indivisible conspiracy. This, of course, was rubbish. What was true was the rather sudden appearance around the turn of the century of a number of independent sexual reform movements, including the Movement for Women's Suffrage, which held its first big demonstration in Berlin in 1894. In the early 20s, a number of homosexual associations sprang up in Breslau, Frankfurt, Lübeck, and other large cities. Hirschfeld had tried, unsuccessfully, to unite them under one umbrella, or under one umbrella organization, but internecine squabbles made unity a mirage. Nevertheless, cooperation among some of the movements grew over time as natural affinities came to be recognized.
And again, obviously, this bears a strong similarity to many aspects of the contemporary feminist and gay rights movements. There has been a considerable intersection between and affinity between the two. So again, we're presenting this by way of pointing out the similarity between Weimar Germany and the situation today. Continuing with the Pink Triangle. Hirschfeld's triumphant moment may have arrived in September of 1921 when he organized the first Congress for Sexual Reform. Experts came from all over the world to discuss such topics as genetics, sexology, and the law. The Congress was such a success that Hirschfeld was emboldened to create the World League for Sexual Reform, which at its height claimed a membership of 130,000. Nobody has written more vividly about the Institute than Christopher Isherwood, especially in his memoir, Christopher and His Kind, 1976. For a time, Isherwood lived in one of the upper rooms of the Institute's buildings. Photographs in the Institute's collection depicting the sexual organs of hermaphrodites shocked him, as did the drawings of one of Hirschfeld's psychotic patients, in which phalluses reigned and strange couplings took place. Isherwood reveals a more complicated reality than the one he had described earlier in Goodbye to Berlin, 1939, in which he presented a gravely distorted vision of a city peopled by rough working men, charmed by the handsome writer from England. By the way, interrupting, of course, Christopher Isherwood's work, as I'm sure many of you are aware, served as the basis for the popular musical and movie Cabaret, which many people, I would recommend seeing that if you can pick up the video cassette. Very relevant. Continuing. In 1976, Isherwood acknowledged certain brutal realities, that Hirschfeld had repeatedly been beaten up by right-wing thugs, and that he had barely escaped an assassination attempt in Vienna. What Isherwood doesn't mention is the abuse Hirschfeld suffered at the hands of the right-wing press whenever he lectured. After one physical assault, for example, a Nazi paper sneered, quote, "It is not without charm to know that Hirschfeld was so beaten that his eloquent mouth could never again be kissed by one of his disciples," unquote. Das Schwarze Korps, the official propaganda sheet of the SS, and Hitler's personal newspaper, the Völkische Beobachter, were particularly vicious. They usually varied three invectives in several combinations. Hirschfeld, the Jewish homosexual commie pervert masquerading as a scientist, seeks only one aim, to permit homosexuality to flourish, which would mean fewer babies, and thus the German nation would be weakened. However, neither the Nazi propaganda sheets nor the few liberal papers that took a more benevolent view of Hirschfeld had as much impact on the majority of Germans as did the mainstream yellow press. There, his institute was lumped together with transvestite nightclubs, houses of prostitution, gay bars, and general rot in Berlin. The capital was Sodom anyhow, it was said, a city where bureaucrats swindled decent people out of money, a city without a soul, a city controlled by Jews and perverts. Incidentally, I would add that Berlin was one of the areas in Germany that had a very liberal attitude towards homosexuals of both sexes. Also, note here the similarity between the way the Nazis used homosexuality. Hirschfeld, the leading figure of the gay rights movement in Weimar Germany, being both a Jew and a homosexual, also, they, although it's not in this passage, a very liberal person politically, well, this was used to tar their opponents with the onus of sexuality, or of homosexuality, and again, they're unnerving reflections of this same kind of a pattern in today's society, where we see conservative Republicans, some of the more flamboyant of the religious evangelists, talking about the Democrats and the liberals as the purveyors of homosexuality and corruption and so forth. Again, continuing. People in small provincial towns came to loathe Berlin as a center of corruption. Whatever opinions they might have held about Hirschfeld's committee weren't helped by a clumsily produced film about homosexual blackmail, different from the others, released in 1919. It starred Conrad Veidt, or Veidt, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, Veidt, who became famous a year later for his portrayal of the somnambulist in the cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and in a small part, Magnus Hirschfeld himself. The film was banned in Munich, Stuttgart, and Vienna. In 1927, it was re-released, but Hirschfeld's part was cut out. Moreover, the problems of belonging to a third sex, unquote, must not have seemed very compelling to the vast majority of heterosexual Germans struggling to cope with unemployment and inflation. And now we're going to go into one of the most important parts of this book, a key apparent provocation which was used to defame the gay rights movement, to attribute to join in the public's mind liberalism and homosexuality and murder. And again, this was used very cleverly by the Nazis, and as we're going to talk about, something which has unnerving reflections for contemporary America. This is the Fritz Haarmann case.
We're going to be continuing here from the Pink Triangle. The Fritz Haarmann that Dave refers to, the name is spelled H-A-A-R-M-A-N-N, just so you know. The film, however, was of minor importance for the homosexual rights movement compared with the shocking murders that occurred in Hanover in 1923 and 1924, culminating in the trial of a certain Fritz Haarmann. Simply put, it was a disaster for Hirschfeld's and the committee's efforts to liberalize the law. It splintered the movement irreparably, fed every prejudice against homosexuality, and provided new fodder for conservative adversaries of legal sex reform. In addition, it pitted the Social Democrats unwillingly against the Communist Party. Most historians of the Weimar Republic have neglected the trial. But Haarmann dominated the headlines for months, and the passions he aroused did much to weaken the struggle to abolish paragraph 175. The trial took place during July 1924 in Hanover, a medium-sized northern city, a place known as much for its black market as for its huge number of prostitutes and hustlers. Interestingly enough, Hanover had been the birthplace of Karl Heinrich Ulrichs, who, it will be recalled, had been among the first in the 19th century to urge greater tolerance toward homosexuals, writing over the course of many years a dozen books that were collectively titled Researches on the Riddle of Love Between Men. Until 1869, when the stringent Prussian penal code was extended, Hanover was one of the handful of German states that did not punish homosexuality. Fritz Haarmann, a homosexual, small-time crook who had spent most of his life in and out of insane asylums and prisons, sold second-hand clothing and jewelry and third-rate food, mostly meat. He also acted as a police informer, which for a time saved him from being suspected of a series of spectacular murders. It was Harman's habit to pick up, quote, for interrogation, unquote, destitute youngsters at Hanover's railroad station or some other center of the black market. He then took them to one of his ever-changing slum apartments near the banks of the Leine River. He murdered some, but others he let go. Of those he killed, he cut off head and limbs, severed the flesh, fed it through a grinder, and sold it in small, well-wrapped packages as horse meat. The black market absorbed all this until too many skulls and bones were found washed up on the banks of the Leine River. As more details were uncovered, it emerged that Haarmann not only carried a police badge, but had founded his own phony detective agency. Haarmann, though a psychopath of low intelligence and no grasp of reality, did possess a shrewd talent for deceit, and he had actually assisted the police in solving several crimes. He confessed readily. He did not recall details, names, faces. He remembered that sometimes, overcome by sexual rage, he bit through his victims' throats. And thus, ancient tales of werewolves and vampires were thrown into the legal proceedings. Altogether, criminologists and pathologists reconstructed 147 cases of missing persons. Hirschfeld was called from Berlin as an expert witness, but he never wrote about the case. Conservative businessman Friedrich Radziwiłł, head of the League for Human Rights, did. He sent a letter to the leading newspapers in which he strongly protested, quote, the yellow press, which tried to identify homosexuals with this feeble-minded criminal. The homosexual minority in our nation emphatically rejects these insulting remarks, which equate homosexuality with criminality, unquote. Haarmann admitted to 127 murders and asked to be executed. He alternated between crying and cajoling and pleaded insanity. The court sentenced him to death.
Those of you who are taping off the air, we're going to change tapes now. Those of you who eventually hear the program by tape, there'll be a short pause while we effect some engineering changes here.